And so we've been looking at being church over these last few weeks, and we've been particularly looking at the passage in Acts 2. And this morning, I want to title it Whole-Brained Christianity. So Acts 2, 42 to 47 says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer, and everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold their property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people, and the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. What an exciting image of what the church should be. Who thinks that that's what we should be like on a Sunday morning? Great. So I was given the title of all the believers were together and had everything in common, which felt a little bit of a stitch up because it's just one line in a whole great passage. But I'm going to do my best to explain some of that this morning. Now, I love podcasts. I listen to podcasts all the time. I'm a big Diary of a CEO fan, so if anybody else out there likes that, I'll talk to you about that all day. I listen to faith ones. I listen to comedy things. I love podcasts. One of my all-time favourite podcasts is actually by my brother, and it's called On the Peak of Mount Stupid. And the principle of the Peak of Mount Stupid is that we learn about something new, and we feel great because I know all the information. I have to tell everybody all about this. And then we'll learn a little bit more. And then we hit the valley of despair because we realize we actually know nothing. This morning, I am standing on the peak of Mount Stupid. And I want to try and explain to you something new that I've been learning about called neurotheology. So Joe, the guitar guy, is going to touch brain science. I've been learning through this amazing book called The Other Half of Church, and if you're a reader, I would highly, highly, highly recommend this book. It is absolutely fantastic, looking at how we use our whole brains to encounter God. So that's some of what we're going to be unpacking this morning. But we're looking at this line of all the believers were together and had everything in common. Now, this is what community looked like in the church for many years, and actually was a reflection of what community looked like in the world. You know, families lived together for multiple generations. Grandparents were part of the home. People didn't sort of move on in the same way. You would go into your family business. You know, you'd be blacksmiths and you'd have that as, at your home, and it's how you'd work. And community was part of everything. Church and culture looked very different those days to the image of the world that we see today. You know, we live in a divided world, even right now with war going on in Ukraine and Palestine and Israel and the civil war in Sudan and even, I mean, looking back a few years, whichever way you voted, it doesn't matter. It's actually Brexit was a separation and a dividing thing. We live in a divided world. So what happened? How did we get from what the world looked like to today? Well, 400 years ago, there was the age of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was where it was kind of summarized as reason being the primary source of authority and legitimacy. Basically, the focus became on the brain being the most important part of the body. So fast forward that a little bit further. We've gone from being spiritual and understanding that we have community and that we're together to that actually it's now all about the brain and cognitive function. Fast forward that to Industrial Revolution, and we see this like amazing developing industry and building there. And all of a sudden, families were kind of starting to be separated because people would leave their family trade to go and work in industry. Children then all of a sudden started to become raised in childcare situations and education. Not bad things, but it was just a change and a shift from home life. And then with increased wealth, families no longer needed to all live together. So grandparents and families weren't actually all in the same homes. There'd be multiple homes. And then fast forward that even further, and we've been led to entertainment was no longer something that a whole community would go and enjoy together. It wasn't that we'd all go and watch a performance or hear songs together. Actually, entertainment was something I could personally enjoy in my home on TV or nowadays in the palm of my hands. We have become more individual and more isolated and less relational beings over time. We all recognize that? Yeah. And this has also been reflected in church, because the focus over time has become more about large gathered church. I literally do this in my role. I'm not, you know, knocking large gathered church. I do that here and part of New Wine. But actually, it becomes more about this sort of big thing together instead of small community discipleship settings. And actually, if church is only about the large and is only about us coming in and receiving something on a Sunday morning, we limit community because it's actually very possible to be here and be really lonely on a Sunday morning. There are people who, even in this space right now, will be feeling lonely amongst this crowd. And it's possible to feel divided, even in a community together. Adam a little while ago said, a divided church has nothing to say to a divided world. You know, many parts of our church practice are even built around systems that do character formation in isolation. Spiritual disciplines are things that we practice alone. Teaching that we sit, even right now, you're sitting and reflecting and listening to what I'm saying. Meditation, and none of these things are wrong. They're actually all amazing things. But, and let's remember I'm standing on the peak of Mount Stupid here. I'm going to explain a little bit about the brain and brain science and neurotheology that might just change our approach to these things. So we have a bit of a cultural understanding that the brain, in the brain that we have right-sided brain and left-sided brain. And we would almost even refer to it as like right-sided brain people and left-sided brain people. So there are those who are right-brained, who are supposed to be intuitive and creative free thinkers. They're the big picture thinkers who experience the world in terms that are descriptive or subjective. And then we have like left-brained people who tend to be more quantitative and analytical, and they pay attention to the details and a bit more ruled by logic. So who here would put themselves as a right-brain person? And who here would put themselves more as a left-brain person? Great. Us right-brain hippies living for, you know. Through a whole load of scans on different brains, and this is putting artists alongside mathematicians at the same time, actually, this theory has been proven wrong. Because actually, we all use the right side and the left side of the brain for all functions. The right side of the brain is non-verbal, and it's our immediate processor. So it's analysing our surroundings all the time. It's monitoring faces. It's reading for danger. And the right side of the brain is where our emotion comes from. It's our senses of touch and taste and smell and sight and hearing are all connected to the right side of the brain. And the right side of the brain is monitoring our surroundings and using our memories or past experience and knowledge to build an understanding of all that's going on 6 times a second. So this is just going on all the time, analysing. That's the right side of our brain. And the left side of the brain is actually where the conscious thoughts are then processed and then have an impact on our identity. And it's actually, it's responsible for deep thought. So our conscious thought happens in the left side of our brain. And we all process our thoughts from the back of the right side of our brain to the front and then over to there and back. Like, I guess like shopping aisles, kind of up and down. And I think that's probably why in a moment of panic, and a moment of, you know, immediate things there, actually, our initial response is an emotional response because actually it's being reflected through the right side of our brain. The left side of the brain is much slower than the right side of the brain. The right side of the brain's running 6 times a second. The left side of the brain is a mere 5 times a second. But it's probably why in a moment of panic or in a moment of danger, we react emotionally because actually it's being filtered through our emotional response and we're responding to past experiences. Oh, when this has happened in the past, this is what that was like and that was bad. If we just take a second to pause and we allow our much slower left side of the brain, conscious thought to catch up, actually, if we breathe, sometimes we're like, oh, hang on a minute, this actually doesn't matter, does it? It's not really as important to me as I initially thought. But in our immediate reaction, because we're responding through emotion and responding through our past experience, that's what happens. So if we think about this from a theological perspective, God has put a lot of power into the function of senses, of memory, of story, and of emotion. So they must be important in our development of followers of Jesus, mustn't they? Our right brain governs the relational life, who we love, our identity as individuals and as a community. And character formation is actually governed by the right side of the brain, not the left side of the brain. And if we want to grow as disciples of Jesus, we must involve activities that stimulate our right brain. So why does this all matter, I hear you ask? I didn't hear you, but... Thank you. Oh, no, he didn't. Great question, Vic. Character change needs full brain engagement. But as I've just said, much of the way that we currently do church is actually left brain dominant. So modern church is built around systems that do character formation in isolation. We do spiritual disciplines and we practice them alone. We do teaching, we sit and reflect. And actually, if we focus only on left brain activities, it means that we have to learn that we need to obey Jesus. And then we change our behavior out of obeying Jesus. Whereas actually right brain, relational development, introduces me to the person of Jesus, and then I form relationship with him. And that's where character formation actually is healthy and whole. And spiritual disciplines are often left brain dominant activities. And often fruit in those can actually be a bit hit and miss. Anybody here given a spiritual discipline a go and after a while just found it really hard and given up? No, okay, no, there are a few of us, it wasn't just me. And I think some of that becomes because if we just do it out of obligation, if we just do it out of trying to obey Jesus with my mind, actually it's ineffective because as Jim Wilder says here, left brain Christianity not only leads to a lack of character growth, but it leads to relational environment that is optimal for narcissism to flourish. So let me say it again. If we just focus on left brain Christianity, it leads to a lack of character growth, but it also leads to a relational environment that is optimal for narcissism to flourish. So narcissism is a self-centered personality style characterized as having an excessive preoccupation with oneself and one's own needs, often at the expense of others. And what does narcissism look like in the church? Well, we can probably all quite quickly draw a picture of a narcissistic leader. You know, these sorts of things make it into the press all the time, and it's a leader who builds a community all around themselves and their own abilities and their own, you know, they're preoccupied with themselves and they don't actually allow themselves to be open to challenge or to accountability. And we see this time and time again, leaders who build platforms and they aren't accountable to anybody, and then we see these dramatic falls and breakdowns in the church. But actually, narcissism is not just about a narcissistic leader. Actually, it can be each and every one of us in our approach to coming to church. Because if it's a self-centered personality style, having an excessive preoccupation with myself, then actually I can come into church and be like, come on, Joe, you better pick some good songs this morning. Or, I don't like this speaker, I'm tapping out. Or, those kids are loud and distracting. That's my kids, sorry about that. Or even like, Holy Spirit, you better come and sort me out today. And if our approach to coming into this place is entirely self-focused, actually, we totally miss the point of what all the believers were together and had everything in common is all about. You know, in the early church, when all the believers were together and had everything in common, I'm not saying that they had no challenges and people didn't wind each other up. Because let's be honest, people are annoying and we can all annoy each other at different times. I'm sure that's the same in the early church as well. There was a brilliant meme that I was trying to find, but it's gone. All about someone saying to Jesus, Jesus, when he says, do we have to love everybody? Do we even have to love Dave? And Dave goes, yes, suck it. And Dee's like, not now, Dave, come on. So yeah, people are annoying. We can all do that, can't we? Our capacity to process and form our character is linked to our capacity for joy. This is something I'm finding really interesting. The human brain develops through joy and attachment. Joy and attachment are the keys for us developing as healthy Christians. Our loving attachments drive our character development. Think about that for a minute. God has made us hardwired that joy and attachment are the keys to developing us as healthy Christians. We are hardwired as humans to work out difficult situations and processes together. It's why actually it's possible to have a joyful funeral surrounded by family and friends, because actually we are hardwired to work out difficult situations together. And in this book, The Other Half of Church, Jim Wilder says, from the brain's perspective, trauma happens when any time we suffer alone. Suffering turns into trauma when we're unable to process our suffering with God and with other people. So I was saying about the right side of the brain is running 6 times a second, analyzing situations around us. It's reading faces. You know, we are hardwired to build joy through face-to-face interaction. We're actually hardwired to build joy through face-to-face recognition. Our subconscious brain is always looking at the faces around us and sensing danger or sensing love, sensing affection, and it builds joy. It's literally how we're designed. How beautiful is it that God built us to build joy through faces? other people's faces. Like, isn't that just the most amazing thing? And we all know that idea of somebody's face lighting up when you walk in the room, or someone you haven't seen for a long time and you see each other and it's like literally joy is expressed through your faces and actually that reflects to them. Or like a child's face lighting up when they've done something amazing and you praise them for it. And like, God has wired us like this. And the most amazing thing is his face lights up when he sees us. And when it's often referred to joy in the scripture and the Lord's joy, it's almost like this. It's his face shining upon us. Scripture is full of passages that talk about God's face shining on us. You know, one of the biggest worship songs in recent history is the blessing and that promise from Numbers 6:24, which is the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious toward you. The Lord turn his face to you and give you peace. Just think about those words in the context of my basic brain science for a minute. God makes his face shine on you. The radiant, gentle, loving, affirming presence of God. And if we're hardwired to work out difficult situations in community and in love, even if you're alone, God is saying, I am that community. I am that love. I am looking on you. My face is shining on you and giving you peace. Whoa. Does that not amaze anybody else? The very face of God that builds that right brain joy and comfort that leads to left brain processing and healing and transformation. Like, his face does that whole journey for us. And even from a young age, a child can recognize whether a face is in person or whether it's on FaceTime. And actually, screens do not fill our joy tanks in the same way, you know, real facial recognition does. Who got drained during Zoom meetings and hours of that during COVID? It's like it was looked into that it just didn't give us the same energy back or the same joy. It robbed us because of the flat nature of what that was. And food is also intrinsically linked to joy. Sharing food together, like the bring and share after church, and looking into people's faces as you enjoy food together actually builds our joy. And actually, one of the things with this is that phones at the dinner table are so destructive for our joy and for those around us, because actually it robs, there was some conviction going on over there, that was the, but it robs the people around us of our face. If we're stuck in our phone, we're robbing the people of our face. And also phones in themselves steal our joy because it just takes away that reality of those people in front of us. The face of God matters. And one of my all-time favorite ways of spending time with God is to actually sit and imagine the face of Jesus. And that was even before I read this book. Imagine what difference those spiritual disciplines would have if we aren't just doing good practices to obey Jesus, but actually we're doing these face-to-face with a living God. Imagine if when we're doing quiet time, we're not just trying to do it to silence the world, but actually we're like, Jesus, I'm looking in your face silently in this time together. Imagine what difference that would have. I heard on another podcast a few weeks ago, it was actually Diary of a CEO, was an interview with a neuroscientist, and they were talking about brain health, and she was sharing on like actual measurable results of physical connection between people. And Stephen Bartlett, who hosts it, he was wearing a monitor, and his girlfriend was wearing a monitor, and they were kind of just in their daily life, trying to work out what things stimulated joy and what things were healthy for their brains. And actually, there was one day when he had to get up early, had to leave before she woke up. And so she was asleep, and he just gave her a kiss on the head before leaving. And in the readings, there was a physical spike in her resilience, just from a kiss on the forehead, in her subconscious. She wasn't aware. It wasn't like, oh, he's here. It was like, actually, the physical interaction raised her resilience. Guys, we're not just hardwired for the face of God, but we're literally wired for physical engagement and interaction. And this is not an introvert-extrovert thing. We can't actually use that as an excuse in this one here. This is actually for all of us. Hugs, kisses, physical contact, handshakes, smiles, just proximity to other people builds our brain health because we're literally wired like this. Sleeping near people actually builds resilience. Like babies sleeping near the mother actually builds resilience in a baby. Why don't you just look around and smile at somebody for a minute? Isn't that nice? Just building a bit of resilience in the room. In Scripture, our English understanding of language is very limited. You know, in a lot of the Hebrew words, there was feeling attached to it. One of my favourite words, I don't know very much Portuguese, but there is a word called saudade. Is that right? I said it right, getting a nod from Isabel. Which is not like, I miss you, but it's like, my gut hurts from missing you. Like, I feel this. It's so much more than just the word, I miss you, friend. It's like, it hurts me to miss you. And one of the words that's often used in Hebrew that we just often translate as love is hesed. And hesed is translated as love, but that's a real simplification of the word. Because actually, it's about love in action, and it's like love that leads to action. It's like, I feel this love, so I have to do something about it. And our word love just doesn't quite, you know, I love Doritos, doesn't quite have the same, maybe I love Doritos and I have to go and get Doritos. Maybe that's how you feel, but there's like the hesed is this, it leads me to action. And so sometimes it's translating as loving kindness or covenant faithfulness or mercy or grace. But it's like, it's not as simple as these words. It's like, I love you and I feel in my gut that I love you, and it's leading me into action. And this is not just romantic love. This is like when Jesus was walking along and he felt compassion on the people. It's like he felt it. So he had to do something about it. Psalm 103 says, bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquities, heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from destruction, who crowns you with loving kindness or hesed and tender mercies. It's a God who loves us with, like, I have to give myself to you. It's like a feeling. It's not just a feeling, but it's like, love and tender mercies. And Jesus absolutely embodied hesed. So where he went, he felt his love and it led to action. Jesus felt compassion and it led to action. And hesed love is essential for us to grow as disciples of Jesus, because it is relational love. You can't have hesed love in isolation. Hesed love is when we rub up against people and we come across their problems and we're like, oh, I have to do something about this. I have to be here. I have to be involved. And so when we think about the idea that all the believers were together and had everything in common, this was like not just love that sees the needs of those around us, but it's like, I see your needs and I'm going to have to respond to them. It's not love that just makes us give on a Sunday morning, but it's like, actually, it leads me to want to participate fully. I want to serve. I want to give everything for the benefit of those around me. So if narcissism is self-centered with an excessive preoccupation with oneself, then worship is the strategy by which we interrupt the preoccupation with ourselves to attend to the presence of God. It's very wordy, but it's one of my favorite translations and understandings of worship. It's Eugene Peterson who wrote The Message, and it's this idea that worship is the strategy by which we interrupt the preoccupation with ourselves. We stop focusing on ourselves. I'm interrupting that, and I'm going to attend to the presence of God. Sim talked last week about being devoted to worship, looking into our own lives, looking at our lives and seeing that lived out for the benefit of the community around us. And that worship is not about expectation or our gain, but it's about freely giving. You know, worship is the strategy in which I take my eyes off of my stuff and I focus on you, Jesus. And when I think about the idea of all the believers being together and having everything in common, I can't help but think about worship, unsurprisingly. But any of the youth or past Create people, you can put your bingo cards away because I'm not talking about Romans 12. It has to be about worship. Why would you go and be a group of believers all in one place? Why would you share everything you had if it wasn't centered around Jesus? They were coming to Jesus. They were coming and seeing the transformation lived out in their lives, and everything comes back to Jesus and the worship of Jesus. The more we center around the person of Jesus and look into his face, the more we are led to be like the person of Jesus and understand that hesed love of God. The more I come and know Jesus, the more that hesed love will flow out of me. You know, the more time I spend around Claire, the more I want to introduce people to her because I think she's great. And the more time I spend in her presence, the more like her I become, and I pick up on her organization, not quite. Her passion's her heart. Vice versa, you know, like, we've been together, we'll be married 15 years next year, because we were married at 9, and I've been working my hardest to get her into bikes for 15 years, and I'm starting to break her down, you know. I'm seeing that change, and she'll be popping wheelies one day. But there's this, the thing, the more time we spend in someone's presence, the more like them we become, the more our hearts align. The more time we spend focused on Jesus, the more that hesed love becomes natural to us. And God has been re-challenging me recently on the concept of worship, evangelism, and justice, all running hand in hand. Because worship and church is not just about what can I gain, but what can I give? The world is all about what can be gained for personal growth. And the church is about what can I give? It should be about being together and giving everything of ourselves to community. Time, money, gifting, heart, passion. First and foremost, we're called to be worshippers of God. And that leads us into that hesed mission. It leads us to want to introduce people to the face of Jesus. The more I spend in God's presence, the more I'm going to want to introduce people to him. And the more my heart is going to become like his, and I'm going to want to live that out in my community. You know, church is a place where we're supposed to come around the presence of God and bring our unique skills. We're supposed to bring our unique qualities and our hearts and our minds and be together. And Joe shared the image of the puzzle a few weeks ago and actually how all the different pieces make up the beautiful full image. And we are better because we are community together. We are better because when we see each other's faces, when we see Keith's face that radiates joy, we are better because of that. You know, we're better because of the differences we all have and how we complement each other. Do we need more Joes in the world? Absolutely not. Because it would be all emotional and full of songwriters, and it would have everyone late to every meeting and spontaneously breaking out with new ideas, and it would be utter carnage. We need to make sure that for every Joe, there's a complimentary Claire, probably, to balance things out. But you are better here when I am my best. Not because I'm awesome, but you are better when I'm operating in the fullness of who God has made me to be. In the same way that I am better when you are your best and you operate in the fullness of who God has made you to be. And we are better because of community. We are better because of Roy serving on reception in the week. And Roy's watching today. He's not in the room. We love you, Roy, and we're better because of you. You know, we're better because of Hades' passion that no one is unseen and actually is passionate about inclusion, us doing that well. We are better because of Rosie's understanding of finance and managing us in that beautiful way that you do. We're better because of Vic's hunger for Jesus and her drawing us into his presence on a Sunday morning, even if we're still waking up. We're better because of Anne quietly mentoring and caring for the young adults in our church. We're better because of Coralie's signing, and we're missing her while she's unwell. Because even if we don't need it, we're better for her act of worship. We're better because of the relentless prayers of Alex and Liz. And we are better because of all the people who serve, care, and love this community week in, week out. Leading small groups, helping in the Lord's larder, mentoring, volunteering at kids and youth groups, giving financially, praying, and being community. We are better when we see each other's faces. And I'm better because of the faces I see in front of me. The way of Jesus was not meant to be lived in isolation. All the believers were together and had everything in common. The church in Acts understood that. And that's our invitation as believers to do that. Should we get the band up? I was struck by a few things, particularly that idea that it's possible to come to church with a narcissistic attitude of this is all about me and this is all about what I gain. Imagine if when we're sat here in this space, we're listening to what God's saying for the benefit of those around us. And I was struck by the reality that God heals our deepest traumas and our deepest challenges through relationship. And so if you've suffered in isolation, and actually even right now you are in isolation, you need to know that the face of Jesus is waiting for you, and he wants to bring that healing and wholeness and transformation. And we as a community want to bring that healing, wholeness and transformation. And I would urge you to go and find people to process things through with, whether that's prayer for growth here, whether that's speaking to a member of the leadership team or the prayer ministry team. But this is not meant to be done in isolation. We are meant to do things face to face because we are better because of that. But as we go into worship, that's usually me. That was good. Yeah, that's good. I know how that feels now. Let's stand up. Let's stand up. Let's stand up for a minute. Let's still ourselves. And I want you to just take a minute to close your eyes and imagine right now that you are standing face to face with Jesus. Don't say any words. Simply imagine his face in front of you. Transformation.